Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is...
Bill Green. Hello, Toby, and hello, everyone. I'm a retired academic these days, but still trying to get some writing done and some scholarship. My substantive position, I guess, is Emeritus Professor of Education at Charles Sturt University in New South Wales in Australia.
And lovely to see you, Bill. Although we haven't seen anything of one another for a long time, we've actually been friends for nearly 40 years since,
I know this.
since we first met.
Yes.
And I have happy memories of lots of time spent together. So it's great to see you, apart from anything else. And of course, I've kept up with your work. But I wonder if you could share with us what's currently happening for you in the sense of what is dynamizing, preoccupying, worrying, interesting you.
Okay. I mean, the thing that's actually that I'm struggling with at the moment is a new project to do with, I guess, simply multilingualism, the whole area of linguistic and cultural diversity. The reason I'm struggling with it is that I got involved in a project with colleagues at Monash University in trying to think about what's happening currently, what are the challenges in language and literacy education in the terms that they were working in. My recent work, and in fact it's been consistent across my career, has been focusing on English teaching and subject English. One of the things there is how my thinking about English teaching has always been informed by cultural studies, the kind of things that we were talking about all those years ago at Deakin University. And not, well, Deakin was another one, but at Murdoch University,
right? Yeah.
One of the sort of foundation places of cultural studies in Australia, as you've written about. What's happened with this is I brought to this work, this new work, a body of some recent work focused on what I call the L1 subjects. And now these are the equivalents of English in other countries. Like, for instance, in Spain, Spanish, French, Scandinavian countries are really big in this. So Swedish, subject Swedish, and so on.
Mm.
And I've extended my long-standing work on subject English in the Anglo world to thinking comparatively about these other subjects in other countries in different parts of the world. We did a book came out in 2020, which was a historical comparative book, bringing together papers from about 11 different countries.
Right.
With their, yeah. So, for instance, as well as on English, there was on Portuguese, but Portuguese in Brazil. So, and we weren't able to get anything at that stage on Portuguese in Portugal. But it did relate to the whole question in terms of my thinking and my attempt to theorize that field, the importance of nation and empire in those particular subjects, but obviously in school systems more generally. So this more recent thing has got me engaged with this whole question of multilingualism within countries which have a national language and the challenge of multilingualism to those, kind of central cultural subjects, which are, interestingly, also across the world, named after the language of that of the country they pertain to. So that's it's been a real challenge because in the case of English teaching, for instance, it's and like all the L1 subjects, it's had this twofold focus on language and literature in
Right.
different countries or whatever. And so, you know, it's kind of easier to think about the literature side of it and all the critiques that have been part of my history and, you know, going back to my Murdoch days. But it becomes really interesting to think about teaching English in a multilingual context, such as Australia is today, as you well know. So that's my biggest challenge at the moment, how to find ways of connecting the whole prob the whole notion of multilingualism to subject English, and then more broadly to what I call the post-national L1 subject.
That's incredibly interesting, Bill. I think about the fact that the astonishing levels of capacity in English that almost everybody in the Nordic countries has, in my experience of being there. And it does vary, and it varies in part by class and by region, and probably by some level of capacity, as it were, but astonishingly good level of English. Whereas in Spain and Portugal, these things are very conditioned by class, and also by the fact that lots of the, at least anecdotally, lots of the people teaching these things in school are not very good at English. And certainly that's true in many cases from when I lived in Mexico, other than, as I'm sure you're aware, in most of the Latin American countries, there is in the capital cities a school run by the United States, not by the government, but a US-run school, a British-run school, a German-run school, a French-run school. And basically what happens is you do biology for 2 hours, 1 hour in Spanish, 1 hour in English. And in the case of the US schools, they get people who have accent-free, ethnic-free English, Ohio English from the Northeast or from California. In the case of the British schools, they get people who have received pronunciation English. What this means is you get people who've never been outside Mexico, but who are in the ruling class, who speak English as if they'd never been outside London or Los Angeles. But outside those places where these teachers are all native speakers who've come to Latin America to earn some coin and have some fun after college, in the public school system, you know, there are people who really can't speak English who are teaching it. And it's very much the same here in Spain and Portugal. And I've often wondered how these things articulate to the sort of disadvantage of being a hegemonic post-imperial language, the disadvantage that many English speakers have in certain ways. On the one hand, it's the lingua franca, we're incredibly lucky. On the other hand, it can cut us off from other cultures and norms. And I think that's part of what is probably happening in places like Australia, right? In terms of working class people who are monolingual and are having a tough time in a country that feels different to them. Would that be a fair guess?
I think it's very fair. I mean, you know, what I've come to recognize is that the sign English is an extraordinarily fascinating thing, as is any other kind of unitary language. You know, kind of the Bakhtinian notion of the unitary language, because there are some of those languages like English, which spread, you know, they're pervasive. They become almost kind of invasive. You know, they take over in various sorts of ways, and in some cases they're seen as an intruder and as an invader. In a country like Australia, What we have, so, the importance of English language teaching, which I would distinguish from English teaching, and I suspect there would be a distinction similar to that to be made in other major kind of unitary language communities. I mean, one of the things that interests me is I want to make the distinction between the sort of stuff I've been working on for most of my career, subject English, and then more broadly those other subjects, those other cultural subjects. I want to distinguish that from English as an international language, which is so tied up with globalization in all sorts of ways. And it's very much connected to elites and their mobility, both literal and virtual. So yeah, I think the whole question of kind of class, caste, and to some extent gender, and certainly race distinctions are really important. This kind of topic.
And Bill, my recollection from years ago when we saw a lot of one another, but also from reading your work then and since, is that sometimes you've been a bit of a lonely voice in debates within education, in and around English, in the sense both of citing Bakhtin, who we just mentioned, or Derrida, or Stuart Hall, or Marx, or whoever, against people for whom really the whole field was meant to be instrumental, technocratic almost. Would that be fair to say? Is that a reasonable guess on my part?
I wouldn't say that the field itself is necessarily technocratic, but you're certainly dead right. I've felt a kind of isolation, and I only realized retrospectively it was the base, it was because of my training and my experience at Murdoch University on, because I was introduced to literary theory and cultural studies there, that as I moved into the education field as a teacher education as a educational researcher, I brought that with me, and it wasn't just a body of references; it was actually a kind of mindset, which I think you might be able to identify with. What I have found is, though there is and there has been growing interesting questions of theory and culture in education, it's had to move out of being a kind of an area with an investment in science, particularly its connection with, say, psychology and psychological science and so on, and that's and also that's meant various sorts of research methods. It's gone from a more experimental field to what now I would say is that there are in some areas strong emphases on ethnography and related things like that. But you're right about the isolation. I found myself in what would characterize my work. I've realized is that I'm not so much interested in the instructional side. That's what I came out of classrooms, but I quickly lost, the validity that might give me. But what I was able to bring was a more contextual and conjunctural perspective to the field, and that's been really important. I don't regret it, though. I wish I'd been more aware of what I was doing as I was doing it.
And Bill, one of the things that I've always wanted to ask you about is that given that you did train as a teacher, as in primary or secondary school,
Secondary, high school,
secondary,
junior high
high
school.
school. What are some of the differences you experienced between teaching those pupils and teaching in college, teaching in university?
Well, I mean, one of the things is, for a start, I think it matters that kids are there under a form of compulsion, right? They're not all that they haven't all opted in, so there is an element where you have to work with the situation. In some cases, in college or a university, you can take a little bit more, in some cases, a little bit more laissez-faire attitude to that. But it's part of the business when you're a school teacher. I mean, one of the things that was interesting about Murdoch back in the days, if you remember, we and I think this might have been before you came, there was a the first influxes of students were people who had failed in the school system or had left it early, particularly women, who were coming back. So it wasn't a question, and they were fantastic students to work with. One of the things that it did show to me that it's not those who are successful at school are not necessarily through any special virtue, you know. There are various things that have contributed to their success, and to their, their problems with the schooling system. So, that I think that's an important part of why schooling or public schooling or whatever we want to call it, mass schooling, is a really important and I think underappreciated, disregarded area of the cultural field.
And but pardon me, Bill, I'm under severe pressure from the podcat to feed him.
I can see that.
He
You want to
just
stop?
knocked over a lamp, and so I'm listening to you, I'm with you, but I'm also on the move a little. So that is really interesting. One of the things I wanted to ask you as well is this. I know that in Western Australia, where we both once lived, there were attempts to bring literary theory into the secondary curriculum, into the high
Yep.
school curriculum. And this was long after I was living there, and maybe after you were living there too. And I know that, and I understand there was a lot of resistance to this. And I'm interested to know to what extent you've found amongst teachers, by which I'm referring in this case not to university professors, but to professors in high schools and so on, what kind of response you've experienced to your curriculum innovations, the things you write about, and the push towards conjunctural, contextual, and theoretical forms of literary interpretation and language acquisition.
I think it's been a slow journey, particularly in terms of embedding that kind of work in ways that kind of really take. There have been various kind of cosmetic take along the line, but I think the sort of literary theory and cultural studies initiative, if you like, is in Australia at least, and to some extent elsewhere, and in different ways, it has materialized. It's trickled through. It's one of the options that the field has in terms of its, its development, but there's also been resistance, and including resistance from government. As you know, from I was at Murdoch in the I left in the late 80s. that decade was seeing the rise of what was called then the new right. The liberal conservative turn, as it was called at that stage. And that can, that rolled on, that liberal conservative restoration in various sorts of ways. And in some cases, well, I think not in some cases, perhaps more generally, manifested, morphed into neoliberalism. So one of the things that was part of that ongoing things was people outside increasingly saw the politic what they saw as the politicization of, school English, labeling it in a very strange way, postmodernism gone mad. There's lots of media debates and various kinds of what I think are manifestations of the culture wars, is also the theory wars, in various sorts of ways. So while there has been, I think, very interesting signs of engagement with that body of theoretical work, there's also been increasing struggle, resistance, and in some cases refusal, both inside and outside the field.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, Bill, or there are many, but is Charles Sturt, which is in a sense a federation, isn't it, of different places. And
Yes.
it's in a sense they're in the boonies, and one of your major concerns has been things like rural literacy, rural learning. It seems to me that there is a bias in cultural studies towards the urban that is very long-standing. And whilst you might get interesting binaries set up, Raymond Williams' The Country and the City would be a classic that still matters, there really is an overload of attention to urban life and insufficient attention to rural slash regional questions, politics, cultural experience, etc. I wonder if you could comment a bit on that and also perhaps give us a bit of a tour of some of the concerns that you and others have had about rural and regional literacies.
Partly that has come about as I've moved, and as I moved out of the cities. I was at When I was at Deakin University, I was at Geelong, and it often, we still had a reference point to Melbourne, but there was this huge, it always struck me, there's this huge space behind us. Then I moved to the University of New England and to Armidale, and then from Armidale to Charles Sturt, again in New South Wales. It felt very strange to be in New South Wales, I have to say, but that's by the by. And because I was in those situations, I felt a need to kind of research, direct some of my research energies towards those kinds of issues, and I learned a lot by doing that, and got involved in the field of rural education and rural teacher education, and again, sought to bring theory and politics to that those kind of areas, a cultural studies perspective, if you like, and within that was thinking about rural literacies, the literacy studies field. Has in a way t has tended to be have an urban or a what I call a kind of metro normative a character, as has the rural education itself. Now that's as an aside, Freire is a very important figure, as you know, in the and he was certainly dealing with peasants' literacy in South America. But there was this bias, and I think there is still a notion that that cultural production, as well as economic production, and that include and cultural production includes knowledge production, is generated from the center, from the metropolis. What's been really interesting over the sort of 15, almost 20 years that I was working in that area is that there has been a resurgence, certainly in Australia, connection to the American scene and in Europe as well, a fairly significant rural education movement, and it's been wonderful to see that happening, drawing on different bodies of work to think through its issues. The whole idea, something else that I must mention here is, and you may well know of this, the centre that Graham Turner was organising from Queensland. There was a strand of that was around rural cultural studies, and that was I think very, very interesting. They've done some very fine work in that area. But the whole question of literacies, cultural sort of practices, the arts, with a rural and regional orientation, is something I think is needs to be attended to and valued in various sorts of ways. I mean, one of the things that's in my mind in this regard is, referring back to Western Australia, I've always had a connection to the West Australian writing scene. I was involved with that myself, from late teens, I've since come to think of that kind of regional literature and cultural production as really, really interesting in terms of where value is being distributed, and in terms, you can think about that in terms of Australia, but I'm sure there'll be equivalents in other sorts of areas. Sometimes regional and rural connects in really, really interesting ways to questions of class and race, ethnicity, and so on. And I think, internationally, that would be, something that needs to be perhaps more on the agenda.
I think the other element here, of course, which does relate to the Raymond Williams notion, is mythology. In many of the Nordic countries, the mythology is that, we're really from the country and everybody has to ski and everybody has to have a ski lodge, even if they're not necessarily particularly well off. In the United States and Australia, this notion that you can't really trust city people, but you can trust country people. That's where the real Australia is, or the real America. The fact that almost nobody lives in these places compared to the cities, nevertheless, doesn't seem to militate against the power of this foundational, quite imperialistic mythology, which of course then has to deal with the realities of rural poverty, massive disadvantage, discrimination, and urban snobbishness. So it seems to me that there's quite a lot of work to be done there.
And also, I mean, the fact that in Australia, say, the rural settlement was at the expense of other people, the whole terra nullius notion, and that's something that's emerging big time in rural education research now, a growing awareness of that. So as well as the imaginary that you're looking at, the wake in fright phenomenon. You know, the horror of out there. I suspect there's a kind of unconscious and not so unconscious concern about Aboriginal people and history and culture, particularly in a period when we've had the referendum here, and the failure of the yes vote in that regard, which I think is a matter of some disgrace for Australia itself. But I mean, again, that is why I think thinking the rural becomes so interesting, because we're not just talking about statistical disadvantage. We're talking about powerful cultural imaginaries which are tied up in important ways to what now is climate change, what now is environmental devastation. In Australia, for instance, the Murray-Darling Basin, which I've done some work on as an object of literacy. It was one of the focuses of our work on rural literacies. It's something that's tied up, I believe, with the kind of self-understanding of the nation as it seeks to rebuild itself in a very different world from, at least the first half of the 20th century. I think that, that's important, important things to, that there are things there that still need to be explored. And I wish I had a few more years, but I probably don't.
But if we think about in a place like Australia, but you could say the same about Canada, you could say the same about Sweden, you could say the same about Norway. These are places that, in addition to their massively subsidized agricultural sectors, have extraordinary so-called natural resources. And of course, this is why Australia is one of the worst environmental criminals in the world in the contemporary moment, alongside China, India, and the United States. Of course, we in Western Europe are very good people, Bill. You do know that.
I understand that.
It's all fine over here. They have these extraordinary natural resources. And so, in addition to the mythology of the country, there is this almost complete economic dependence on it, on rural Australia. I mean, the country would be fucked economically without it. I mean, in northern Western Australia, parts of Queensland, it's just a place to dig, but it's got lots of stuff people need, right? I mean, it's re and now we're seeing whole new cities being created in northern Sweden, because the very places taken from the Sami people, of course, that were the basis of the industrialization of Nordic countries through the discovery of iron ore and the ability to make ball bearings and stuff like that, now is the place where they're finding alternatives to China's quasi-monopoly on rare earth materials, right? Which, of course, are also in Chile and they're in Australia, but there's a huge amount in northern Sweden. So suddenly there's a rush to the north, just below the Arctic, to push the Sami out of the way if they're not playing ball. This is a story you'll know all too well in the context of uranium and indigenous peoples in Australia. So there
Absolutely.
is this, in addition to this bizarre condescension from the city, mixed with notion of this is the real right in the name of your preferred country, i.e. rural areas, there is also an extraordinary fundamental economic dependence on places where not many people live, as opposed to places where lots of people live. And I guess that's one of the things that I've really come to understand better in the last few years. It should have been obvious to me, but it takes sometimes changes in one's own life to see them. And actually, that brings us to something I also wanted to ask you about. Excuse me. Bill, you've lived in cities. You've lived in a sense, periphery of cities, in the case of outside Melbourne. You've lived in pretty big country towns, and you've done so in three states of Australia. I think that's right.
Yes.
What's it been like adjusting to those differences? Because you grew up in Western Australia, which, for people who don't know, is twice the size of Texas, and essentially it's got one pretty big city. And then some other places with several tens of thousands of people living in them, but really Perth is the smoke, as it were. But it is an extraordinarily, in inverted commas, isolated place, particularly for a big city. And then you've gone to these other places that are quite culturally distinctive. And I wondered if you could just chat a bit about what it was like being a growing up in Western Australia, becoming a teacher, becoming a scholar there. And then moving as a scholar to different contexts. And this is also relevant, folks, because as in the US, education in Australia is a state's right under the constitution of the nation. And so, although the feds have a big part to play, especially in universities where they fund historically over the last 60 years, most of them, when it comes to curriculum and so on, it's still very much a state's dominated area. Yeah.
It is, except for the national curriculum, which is called grandly the Australian curriculum, which was set up in 2011.
I don't know about that.
And it's been, it's a big initiative, et cetera, and so on. But the states still have the right to either work with it or to adapt it, or in some cases to move, to kind of say, like New South Wales, to say, well, we really know how to do this. So there is a certain, there's a growing federal involvement and an attempt to steer the system, not just through the national curriculum, but through a national testing regime. So which connects to those league table testing schemes, like PISA and so on. So but it is still the case that the state cultures have historically been really important and continue to be in determining and assessment. So there is there's there have been significant changes, but I think people still tend to be identify with state cultures. For me, getting back to the to your question, the first part of the question was, yes, I was, Perth born and bred. I went to the university that had been there for decades, the prestigious university. University of Western Australia, and I was one of four members of the honours class, which crossed over to be the first four postgraduates or graduate students at Murdoch. Those were the days we didn't have, and now it's got all this wonderful vegetation, but then it was sand and bricks. And then I was involved. I was at Murdoch on two separate occasions for a good many years. But my whole experience was of Perth as a city. My family came from Kalgoorlie, a kind of classic mining community, 5 hours out. I had taught in different schools out there. I was sort of shell-shocked. I was My experience was like the experience of many young teachers trained in the city, sent out there to teach, in my case, teach English in sometimes these very, quite small high schools. At least they were high schools. And some of us got involved and got adjusted and became adjusted and had very successful careers. Many of us fled back to the cities when as soon as we could. So I had done my country service. I some two or three years, and I came back to the city and did a further 2 years before going into back into the university, graduate work, cultural work, and so so in my own history is that whole thing about here and out there, So there is a clearly, in terms of the research I've been doing in that area, that strand of my work, there is this kind of autobiographical thing. And I'm often coming across, reminders of what I did and think and thought, and how I connected and didn't connect in teaching English in those contexts. So yes, so I've since, as you say, outside the main cities or on the periphery. In Victoria, in New South Wales, it's been, I have to say, extraordinary experience to go out, into real outback, along the Darling River and so on, I've done that, in the course in the context of several projects, and that's actually given me a better feel for the challenge of distance, the challenge of isolation, which is part and parcel of many educators' experience out there. We've still got the problem that it's perceived as that. We still have to staff those schools. They're being produced. They're being trained. In either cities or larger urban areas, and there's very little attention given to the specificity of teaching in these diverse communities and contexts out there. That's certainly the case in Australia, but I suspect it's likely to be be something similar in other countries. Distance mightn't be the problem. In some cases, it's terrain. And so, and as you say, it's also connecting and sometimes confronting indigenous populations, because many of them are still living in these contexts and communities. You mentioned the Sami, for instance, and that would fit here.
And I've got a couple more questions, Bill, and then what I'd like to do is conclude by throwing to you so that you could add anything that we've not touched upon or where we have, but you'd like to say something more. Is that okay as a way of concluding?
Oh, that's good. That's good.
All
That's
right,
good.
lovely. So, second last question. You can start to take deep breaths there in your impeccable rugby shirt. It looks like a rugby shirt.
It's not quite a rugby shirt, and I'm an AFL man, and that's why coming to New South Wales has been traumatic.
Well, there's one New South Wales team in
Now
the
there's
NRL.
two,
There are two.
and there's now one in Brisbane and another one up in Cairns.
Cairns. Wow, this is northeastern Australia. Yes. Anyway, my first question, Bill, is of these last two, is to ask you how you do the research you do. It's your starter for 10.
I mean, one of the things is I read and read and read and read, right? And that's probably I think I'm perceived as someone who probably reads too much, because it's associated with reading theory and reading certain kinds of things. As well as that, I've been involved in various forms of discourse analysis, But of the discourse analysis that connects with quasi-ethnography, I guess you'd call it, field work of various kinds. So the kind of empirical side of it has always been that sort of field work, whether it's interviews, whether it's observations, that whole area of research. And for me, that connects back to one key aspect of cultural studies, the sort of ethnographic side. The other side is the discourse analysis connects to the textual side. Engaging with constructing texts of various kinds. So, for instance, in a lot of my research across the years, I've used media representations as a kind of text that I draw upon and bring into the work I'm looking at. An early one, for instance, a paper of mine called Aliens in the Classroom, and it was picking up on that idea of a kind of new kind of child appearing on the scene, a new kind of young person. At that stage, we were looking at the upper school. But you could also, at the, and we made connections, that was a 16-year-old, let's say. On the other side was the 6-year-old, even more at those early days involved in computer games, Nintendo, et cetera. So I would say that one aspect of it is being able to draw upon popular culture and even literary culture as motifs, as images, as kind of text that I can work with in the rhetorical work I'm engaged in as an educational researcher. That's again, it's more common now. It wasn't so common in the 90s. It became, I think it's become part of it. So, that's an important part of the work I do. Fairly mainstream empirical ethnographic work, but also the textual work of various kinds. The other aspect that's been really important to me has been working curriculum history, where I've worked with archives, I've worked with documents, I've worked with historical accounts, and sought to rework them. The distinction between primary and secondary sources, which is sort of foundational for a lot of historical work, is one which I think I can argue is not as stable as some historians think it is. For instance, I would work there with the whole notion of text and commentary in Foucault, where the commentary is secondary to the text, and yet it is more important than the text. That kind of dilemma. In primary and secondary sources in history, I've suggested that you can't so clearly, especially in the course of time, say which is commentary and which is text. And that's so that's characterized some of the historical work I've done, where I've been able to draw upon particular kinds of discourse analysis in conducting historical inquiry. So I think that's the kind of research I've been doing for quite some time now.
And I think it's wonderful as an exemplar, Bill, combining analysis of the text, ethnographic or participant observation, but institutional questions, the discourse of institutions as well as the discourse of the text. I think that really is the best of cultural studies, at least for me, and something that your work incarnates. And in many ways, always has. Funnily enough, Bill, just yesterday I was writing about Tony Bennett's ideas of reading formation. So these things never leave us once we've encountered them.
They
They
don't.
take a grip. They're inside us, Bill.
I
We
know,
fight
I
them
know, I
off,
know.
but they're always there. So no doubt deep down for you, the waffle will always matter more than the AFL. Deep down, there'll be some sort of connection to Bassendean Bayswater or Subiaco or Fremantle or wherever it is, right?
Yeah, well, Fremantle and Swan districts were my teams back in the day. But I think the AFL has now changed the sort of
Oh,
thing.
it's claimed you. Okay, yeah. Because there are two teams in WA in the Australian
Yes,
Football League
there
today.
are.
There are two.
The
There's
Fremantle
Fremantle.
Dockers and the West Coast Eagles.
Right. And the Dockers have never won it, is that right? Or
No, they haven't. They haven't.
but
They're
they're your team.
Yes, well, I'm more connected to the Swans now, Sydney Swans, I have to say,
Oh,
as
are
a
you?
fan,
Okay.
because I've been to some of the games. But I do have, as I say, with the West Australian writing scene, I still have a fondness for that, and I still have a fondness for the West Australian sporting scene too.
So my last question before throwing back to you, Bill, is again a sort of big one. I mean, your answer was wonderful in terms of how you know the things you know. But this is about, in a sense, what we need to know for the future. What are the areas that are being missed in our current conjuncture or in what might be the conjuncture or conjunctures to come? I think you're gesturing at that in your work collaboratively on multilingual literacies. But are there other things that you think one needs to be focused on for the future?
I mean, it's impossible, I think, to go too far away from the specter of climate change. We've had a really hot summer last few years, and I think Europe, has too. Western Europe, and around where you are, there doesn't seem to me much room for doubting that things are changing, and I worry about my grandchildren, right? I think from the point of view of being an educational researcher, this surely has to become more central to the whole project of schooling. And perhaps education more broadly. I think if when it comes to thinking about the kinds of subjects that we do want to encourage information, the kinds of people we want people who are able to think creatively, but also ethically. And politically, and that's always seemed to me to be pretty central to, say, the English subject as I've envisaged it. But it seems to me that it really does have to be central to the project of schooling. A lot of schooling, a lot of the standardized testing regimes are about low level, particularized things because they're easier to test, they're easier to measure. The more complex things are what we should be aiming at. We should be aiming to create a new generation that whose creativity, no matter what the field, is fundamental. Whose imaginative powers, and within that, how do they communicate? How do they communicate those things that matter to them? There's signs that increasingly young people, they're not, then they've never been stupid. They're already thinking, and in some cases, dark thoughts about
Yes.
where that where. So I think that's the thing, an orientation to the future, and how are we going to help them to become the kinds of people that can really make a difference by looking at the world around us as it's changing. So, that would be the main thing.
Beautifully put. Pardon me. And Bill, to conclude, I wonder if there are things that we haven't touched on that you'd like to mention, or areas we have touched on where you've suddenly had a Bill Green brainwave that must be shared with the group.
I don't know about brainwaves, but I think it's probably worthwhile finishing on this note of thinking about the relationship between education and cultural studies as fields of study, if you like. I've always sort of seen myself as working in the space in between. I think education is something that has tended to be underplayed in the cultural studies literature. All right, the people like Grossberg, for instance, have always been emphatic about education mattering and pedagogy mattering. He is talking about college communities as less involvement with schooling, which I think, public schooling since its inception in the early 19th century is really a mass communication system, and now an rather old-fashioned technology. But there needs to be a way of reinventing it as a complex communication practice, both on the populational and on the individual basis, and an interactive basis. So, what I'd really, I mean, I would regard myself as a curriculum theorist these days, and has moved increasingly towards that. What I try to do in thinking about bringing curriculum inquiry and curriculum theory and curriculum history together is, in what ways might we be thinking much more productively about cultural practice, cultural politics, but also cultural pedagogy, I think, one of the things is obviously the whole question of the media as an educator in itself, but also how we go about bringing that as information towards understanding on the part of our students in schools and beyond schools, from information to understanding and then into action. And I'd like to see more attention given to that. There's been the work in Hong Kong, for instance, that Megan Morris was involved in. I think that was a really interesting body of work. And there are signs of it in various ways, but it's always been part of the cultural studies project, and perhaps it needs to be revisited and re-energized in that regard. So that's what I'd like to finish off.
Beautiful. Well, Prof. B, you've been an innovator with an education in terms of being a cultural studies innovator. You've been an innovator in cultural studies in terms of being an education innovator. And it's been wonderful getting to talk to you after all these years. Thank you so much for this.
It's been very good to speak with you again, and thanks for the opportunity.